Once upon a time, there was something deep and hidden within London. A belief. A way of thinking. A movement. Its origins lay in the very roots of the city itself. London has always been a place which was passionately Christian. As was explained over the series, ever since the city became a place where the only noble over the population of any consistency had been its bishops, since those ancient Anglo-Saxon times, London had been a place where their faith had been something visceral, physical, and ecstatic. It's like this undercurrent below the historical surface, a fast-flowing riptide of passion and conviction, unseen by the casual observer, but for those who know the waters of London's past, who bathe in them regularly, we're always aware that it is there. We're always aware that it is ready to snatch people by surprise and drag them into unexpected turns of events. The second king of the Lancasterian family of the Plantagenet dynasty had just been crowned. Henry V was a young monarch with a glorious future ahead of him. But while his story is always linked to the victory upon the fields of Agincourt and the awe of his great conquests, what is often overlooked was that the first significant event of his reign was something much less glamorous, something that erupted on the darkened streets of London and which by all accounts shook the young king to his core. A rebellion, an insurrection, driven by religion, and one which would cause a brutal series of executions upon the streets of London itself, a very London heresy. Hi, my name is Saulin. I'm your host, narrator, and writer of this, The Story of London, a podcast that tries as best it can to tell the chronological tale of this great city and the events that shaped it. We have reached the 147th chapter, and this week we examine the history of the Lollards of London, a group of religious dissenters who actually instigated a battle just outside the city walls. It's a story where we try to uncover this group's history, going back 30 years. Peering through the miasma of vague historical records to try and give shape to what was briefly the most violent and dangerous insurrection in London's long history, and a group whose legacy was to last in the city for centuries to come. Welcome then to a two-part story focused upon the rise and fall of this heresy within London, and the full story of the bloody rebellion of Sir John Oldcastle, the saga of the Lollards of London. And this its first part, examining the origins and growing power of the movement in the years before this bloodbath. Welcome then to a conspiracy of mumblers. There was something hidden in London, something radical and secret. The city, with its population hovering around 40,000 or so, give or take, was by far the largest community in medieval England, as well as being the most usual residence of the kings of England and the seat of all but a handful of this era's parliaments. As such, it was bound to attract all types of people, including those who would in time be called the believers in heresy. This was to become a centre for the Lollard movement. And what were the Lollards? Lollard is a name given to a medieval Christian movement that flourished in England mostly during the latter years of the 14th century and the opening decades of the 15th century. It was not a Protestant movement. We're almost a century away from that movement even starting. But it was a very English response to problems people had with their church. Tradition dictates that the movement was based on the teachings of the Oxford-based theologian John Wycliffe. However, while he did have a heavy influence on what would be called the Lollard movement, there is evidence that says the actual desire for reform of the Catholic faith in England came before he came along. Now, the people who wanted this were never very large in number, but they were passionate, and they could appeal to the poor in rather inflammatory terms. In time, Wycliffe comes along to give such extremist radicalism a respectable face. Here was a honoured academic, teaching in Oxford, using learned terms to ask some powerful questions, like, why should kings obey the Pope and nobles obey bishops? Why were the sacraments so ritualized? And why did people have to go through priests in order to access God? Wycliffe, after all, translated the Bible into English, allowing those who could read and write but did not know Latin access to its teachings, and like many of the later Protestants, allowing normal Christians gain the wisdom of its words. In time, the Lollards differed from mainstream Catholic doctrine in several fundamental theological ways. They rejected the ceremony of communion as the Catholic Church taught it. They did not believe the Eucharist was physically made into the flesh of Christ, a process called transubstantiation. Rather, they believed in a more mystical transformation known as consubstantiation. They believed confession was overrated as a sacrament. They believe that anyone could become a priest. There is much, much more to their theology and their beliefs, and this summary is doing them a grave injustice. But from this basic theological starting point, we need to add into the mix resentment towards the church, not just its riches, but the church's unfailing support of the prevailing status quo. Mix them all together, and what you end up with is the Lollard movement. Its name, by the way, is the source of some confusion. The most widely accepted theory is that it was a name derived from a Dutch word at the time, lollen, to mutter or to mumble, and lollerd, a mumbler. The tradition was that referring to certain poor monks as mumblers was something that had been going on in the Netherlands for quite some time. And the English just applied this Dutch term to a bunch of supposedly, or principally, poor priests. Whatever the actual case for the origin of the name, Lollard was seen as an insult, used to denote these men and women as false and sly, mumblers. So that's who they were. And I'm not going to go into the full history of the movement across England, as that would just take too long. And it's going to be long enough just focusing on the movement within London. And we have to take on board right now that between the years 1376 and 1428, nearly all the notable leaders of the movement known as the Lollards, men such as John Wycliffe, Nicholas Hereford, Philip Repingdon, John Aston, William Thorpe, John Purvey and William Taylor, they all preached in London at one time or another. And a number of lesser Lollards were also drawn to the capital, some of them, no doubt, seeking anonymity on its crowded streets and freedom from persecution, which they faced in much smaller towns. And others came less willingly to face trial before civil or ecclesiastical courts, and in some cases, to face the gallows or the flame. As such, you have to take on board that London was a centre of the Lollard movement, but there are difficulties in working out what Lollard activity in London was due to outsiders coming in, and what activity came from London's residents themselves. There is a quick realization when studying this that the heretics of the city in this era remain in the shadows. And like in some parts of England, where registers of those having dissenting Christian beliefs were made and kept meticulously, in London no such records exist. Perhaps the bishops of London and their registers did not wish to record them so. We do not know, but we do suspect this could have been the case. But because of this, however, We have to search for footprints of Lollard activity in the city from the secular records and chronicles, city government records, and the registers of the Archbishop of Canterbury. To find this heresy in the capital, we have to peer into the shadows. And because of this, there cannot ever be a full and clear explanation of who were the Lollards of London and where they met and what they talked about and so forth. But from their brushes with authority, we do get a story that hints at a secret group working in plain sight just under the surface of regular life. We cannot hear the words of these mumblers, but we can follow their footprints that they leave in the records of the courts. These records speak of a small but passionate Lollard community within the city, who existed long before Henry V took the throne and carried on into the reign of his son. And they give us the impression that it's mostly a movement of the middling sort of Londoner, the smaller merchants, the smaller tradesmen, and the anonymous working poor of the city. Anyway, we'll start at the beginning. To get to the origins of the Lollards of London, we have to peer back in time to around 1372. We covered this era back in chapter 128, when King Edward III was sickening. Between then and a decade later in 1382, we know of at least three occasions where the London mob, which was particularly active back then, intervened or appeared in the trials of prominent Lollards. But we're not too sure if these were due to some kind of religious feeling about it, or because of the violent politics of the time. We know that John Wycliffe himself had gained supporters amongst the citizens of London as early as autumn 1376, where he preached in the city churches at the instigation of John of Gaunt, who was the grandfather of King Henry V and the Duke of Lancaster. John of Gaunt found Wycliffe useful in his opposition towards powerful clergy opposed to him, so he'd wheel him out to push his arguments about curtailing the power of the prelates. The supporters of Wycliffe, however, were certainly around at the time of Wycliffe appeared before Bishop Courtney of London at St. Paul's Cathedral on the 19th of February 1377. Wycliffe arrived at that meeting accompanied by his patron, John of Gaunt, and by Henry Percy, the Marshal of England, and by four Doctors of Divinity, who John of Gaunt had employed to defend him. The supposed trial that was to take place never actually happened, because after an exchange of insults between John of Gaunt and Bishop Courtney, the proceedings were broken up by angry Londoners who hated John of Gaunt and Percy and suspected them of basically planning to overthrow the city's liberties. Though Gaunt was subsequently forced to take refuge from the mob, and several of the Duke's supporters were very ill-treated by it, Wycliffe himself was not apparently harmed. And there can be no doubt that the fury of the Londoners was directed at Gaunt for political reasons rather than Wycliffe for religious reasons. And indeed, when Wycliffe again appeared before the assembled bishops at Lambeth Palace in March 1378, a London crowd actually demonstrated in his favour. Now, it must be said, a demand had already been made by a popular member of the royal family, Princess Joan, that no judgment should be passed upon Wycliffe. The Londoners' motives for this protest can only be guessed at, but while Wycliffe had supporters in London, they were not numbered large enough to fill a mob. Far more likely, the mainstay of the population protested to show their support for the popular princess, rather than an indication of support for Wycliffe or for his radical ideas. But not everybody in that crowd would be there for that reason. It is quite reasonable at this point to suspect that in that demonstration in March 1378, there were London Lollards in that crowd supporting their spiritual champion hidden in plain sight. And then they disappear. A few years later, the Lollards of London show up again, this time around during the trial of Wycliffe's more prominent Oxford supporters at Blackfriars in 1382. On the 18th of June that year, Nicholas Hereford, Philip Repingdon and John Aston had appeared before a committee of theologians and had been tested on their opinions on 24 conclusions which had been condemned by the church as either heretical or erroneous. Now, Hereford and Repington asked for more time to deliberate the issues, which was granted. But John Aston, he agreed to answer their questions at once, and then gave answers that were so ambiguous as they infuriated the theologians. Eventually, all three were ordered to reappear for further questioning on the 20th of June. In the meantime, however, Hereford and Aston appealed to the Londoners by distributing their confessions, written both in Latin and English, which appeared on the streets and marketplaces of the city, nailed to doors and walls. These confessions were fundamentally called to arms. They argued their point of view in these debates, and they asked the men and women to witness their truth. On the 20th, Hereford and Repington were the first to be examined, and though they agreed the 24 conclusions put to them were rightly condemned as heretical, their answers were deemed to be unsatisfactory. Then they were found guilty of heresy. Now, no judgment was passed on them at the time, however, and they were ordered to appear again in about a week or so. John Aston was then produced and was asked to give a reason, if he could, why he should too not be just condemned as a heretic. He immediately refused to give any straight answers to the court's questions and then made jokes at the theologians and bishops' expense. From Aston's behaviour, we get the impression that he actually expected a bunch of Londoners to come rescue him. But they were apparently unable or unwilling or too small to do that, and he was convicted of heresy and imprisoned, probably taken off to St. Albans until November, where he later claimed to have a change of heart, apologised, recanted, and was restored to his status in Oxford University. Please note, this return to orthodoxy was short-lived, and he would soon be in trouble with the London authorities again. Anyway, a week later, Hereford and Repington also made an appeal to the sympathies of Londoners. On the 28th of June, they appeared, as had been ordered, at Blackfriars, and, according to their own account, offered to make a public declaration repudiating their heresy. But during the afternoon of the 28th, however, the two men prepared an appeal to Pope Urban VI against their conviction for heresy, vindicating their own conduct and accusing the clerical court of deliberate injustice. Their appeal was written at the house of one of their London supporters, John Hampton, and was nailed onto the porches of St. Paul's Cathedral and St. Mary Le Bow. Now, we have no knowledge of how the Londoners reacted to these documents. But again, there seems to be this belief between these three leaders of the Lollard movement that they do have supporters in the city, people who sympathise with them and possibly agree with them. All three men appeal to the people of London. However, there was no uprising in their support, and Hereford and Repington were solemnly and publicly excommunicated at St. Paul's Cross soon after. Now, accounts at the time do suggest that the intervention of London's residents and sympathies towards the Lollards were entirely responsible due to one man, the then mayor, John de Northampton, who, if you remember, was allied and a client of John of Gaunt. And well, if you want to know why John de Northampton would have intervened and maybe made insulting remarks about certain members of the clergy, then I'd recommend you go listen to the 10 chapters of the Saga of the Jubilee. Suffice to say, John de Northampton was acting out of political need, not religious conviction. He was never a Lollard sympathiser. And if you want proof of this, I think the best proof lies in the betrayal of his secretary, Thomas Usk. Usk threw de Northampton under every single bus he could and accused him of just about every crime he could imagine. If de Northampton had been a Lollard sympathiser, you can be sure Usk would have called him a heretic. But he didn't, so chances are he really wasn't. But it is clear that some of the supporters of John de Northampton did have Lollard sympathies, if not stronger feelings and sympathy. And when the former mayor was finally released from prison in 1386, one of his sureties was a man called John Claydon, a skinner and common councilman who later became one of the best known of London's Lollards, and we'll talk more about John Claydon in a bit. The story moves on. Around 1381, as we covered in chapters 132 to 135, there was the newest influx of Lollard preaching, which was the preaching of John Bull, the radical itinerant preacher who had become one of the Kentish rebels of the Peasants' Revolt. Whereas Bull's radical demands for violent church reform and the desire for the church to side with the poor predated Wycliffe, he was painted as a Lollard leader. And certainly, I would say you see an element of the Lollard movement hinted at during the violence of the Peasants' Revolt that year, with the systematic looting and destruction of Lambeth Palace. After the Peasants' Revolt, we don't hear anything about the Lollards for a while. Not until 1386, when suddenly there was a further outbreak of high-profile Lollard preaching in London. And the man responsible for this was Master William Thorpe, who'd come from the Diocese of York, but who had apparently learnt his doctrines from Wycliffe himself, as well as from Nicholas Hereford and the other Oxford Lollards. According to an indictment made against him by the Bishop of London, Thorpe had preached at the Church of St. Martin Auger, Candlewick Street, on Corpus Christi Day, either without the bishop's licence or the permission of the rector of the church. The accusation is that after this, Thorpe had also preached at the Church of St. Bennet Hythe, and then finally at least a third time in another church in London, but the authorities either never found out which one it was or just didn't write it down. Now, to this accusation, the Lollard preacher replied to the bishop's indictment with a written statement, full of biblical quotations justifying his preaching. But he was preaching heresy, whatever he said was his reasons for doing it. Thorpe apparently appeared before Bishop Baybrook of London, and not surprisingly, he was convicted of heresy. He refused to recant and was accordingly excommunicated. Whether he was subsequently kept in prison, and if so, for how long, we don't have a record for. But he must have eventually have purged himself, for when he again comes in contact with Bishop Baybrook some years later, the bishop could find nothing against him. There is no direct indication in the record as to the reaction of the Londoners to Thorpe's preaching in at least three churches. But the fact that he did preach in three churches, and he had an audience, probably does suggest that the Lollard movement in the city was growing, and this could explain the events of autumn 1386. During the summer of that year, rumours of heretical activities, probably those of Thorpe preaching himself, reached the government, and in August the royal mandate was sent to Bishop Braybrooke of London, ordering him to arrest all maintainers of heresy in the city and his diocese, and forbidding anyone there from giving any help to heretics. As a result of this mandate, investigations were carried out, and on the 9th of November 1386, Braybrooke wrote to Thomas de Baynton, the Archdeacon of London, informing him that he had heard many reports and complaints that Nicholas Hereford, John Aston and others were active in London. From the text of the Archdeacon's reply, however, and particularly from the fact that the heretics were preaching in private houses, it's reasonable to deduce the existence of quite a large and active Lollard congregation in London at this time. But they were keeping a remarkably low profile. They tended to avoid incidents like the one Thorpe had just done. They avoided churches. They preached and taught in each other's homes, amidst servants and staff and family members. Understand, at this point, the impression we have is that the Lollards of London have been driven or are acting underground. And this was powerful, because existing under the fear of persecution is actually hardwired into the Christian faith. It was part of their very creation as a faith. When persecuted Christianity finds itself in the shadows, it starts displaying some of its more nobler virtues. And so the Lollards grew. They flourished in their own quiet way. But remember, these are passionate Christians. The Lollards are not going to be content with just being allowed to practice their beliefs in private. No, they were not afraid of getting loud about their cause from time to time. And in 1387, we see the growing Lollards of London erupt in London during an incident with a rather rebellious monk. The saga is that a certain Austin friar, a man called Peter Paetschul, saw the merit of the Lollard belief system, and he decided to leave his order of monks and join the followers of John Wycliffe. Encouraged by them, he went to the Church of St. Christopher at Stocks, followed by nearly 100 practicing Lollards, and there publicly preached against the vices of his order, accusing his fellow Augustine friars of, well, amongst other things, fornication, sodomy, and murder. We suddenly see other Austin friars turn up to try and attempt to contradict Petershull, but they were immediately chased away by the crowd, and some were even beaten up. Fired up, the Lollards and possibly others who had been inflamed by these accusations now moved off to burn a nearby Augustine house. And when they arrived, they appeared to be met by a pair of rather skilled preachers of the Austin Friars, and what sounds like, but we're not too sure, a theological debate took place outside the intended house of burning. A preach-off, I suppose. And that lasted long enough that the sheriffs of London turned up and managed to get the crowd to disperse. Petershull was not, however, done. Again, encouraged by his fellow Lollards, he turned his verbal accusations of murder, sodomy, and treason by the friars into written accusations and posted them on the doors of St. Paul's Cathedral. According to contemporary sources, many who saw this bill, including some knights, quote, firmly declared that everything on them was true, unquote. Despite the support he was reported to have received in London, there's over 100 Lollards at least listening to him, encouraging him, and willing to throw fists against Orthodox Christians to defend him. He was apparently forced to run for his life, and on the 18th of July, 1387, the authorities in Leicester arrested him to bring him before the king and the council. This brief flourishing, however, then leads to nothing, and the activities of the London Lollards returns to darkness for more than 4 years. They kept their heads down, it seems, and yet the heresy was lingering, hidden or ignored until December the 10th, 1391, and a warrant was issued by the Archbishop of Canterbury for the arrest of one Nicholas Ipswich, a simple layman who had incurred excommunication by the Archbishop for not appearing in London's Court of Arches to answer a charge of teaching heresies, both within the City of London and beyond. Shortly thereafter, on the 21st of January 1392, perhaps because of the reports they had of this Ipswich preaching around London, the royal authorities ordered the mayor and the sheriffs of London to make a proclamation throughout the city which forbade the holding of secret meetings, which were, quote, gathering together and disputing heretically and erroneously touching upon certain matters of holy scripture and the orthodox faith, communicating and damnably stirring up nefarious opinions, unquote. The authorities went on to say that all who continued to gather themselves together after the proclamation had been made were to be arrested and imprisoned until further notice. The reason given for this order could have been because of Nicholas Ipswich, but it appears that the king and the council had gained intelligence suggesting that, quote, certain lay persons of the city, craftsmen and others, do frequently so meet together in no small number to the subversion of the Catholic faith and for a pernicious example to the people of the city, unquote. So whereas London records don't say there were growing numbers of heretics within the streets of London, the government was clearly alarmed by what appears to be a indeed growing number of heretics within London. On May 26th that year, their order was reinforced by a letter from Bishop Braybrooke to the Archdeacon of London, informing him that certain unnamed men were preaching heresies in churches, chapels, and in private houses throughout the city. The Archdeacon was to report the prohibition of all unlicensed preaching in London and to cite the offenders and their supporters to appear before Braybrooke at Stepney on Palm Sunday. We don't actually know if these anti-Lollard measures of early 1392 were successful, nor if anybody was actually arrested. It is certain, however, that the city's heretics were no more than temporarily suppressed, if they were suppressed at all. And in May 1394, the government issued a further commission to Bishop Braybrook to arrest and imprison Lollards within London. Up until this point, the Lollards of the city had remained unusually anonymous. Although Nicholas Hereford, John Aston, and perhaps William Thorpe could be associated with them as teachers, nothing is known of leaders from London, unless Nicholas Ipswich was one, and we're not sure about his origins. But all that changes in 1395. It seems almost certain that the Lollards of London were implicated in an attempted presentation of a heretical tract called the 12 Conclusions to the Parliament, which sat at Westminster in January and February of 1395. Now, there's no evidence that this tract was ever debated in Parliament, but copies of it, in English probably, were fixed to the doors of St. Paul's Cathedral and Westminster Abbey. The authorship of the 12 Conclusions is usually ascribed to a man called John Purvey, who then resided in Bristol, and there's no evidence to say it came from the London Lollard community. But we do know that it would have been Londoners who nailed copies of the 12 Conclusions to the doors of St. Paul's and St. Peter's Westminster, elegant proof that this Lollard heresy was still active in London. And the sheriffs of London were ordered to make a number of arrests of suspected heretics at this time. The following roundup saw they, as well as the authorities in London, being ordered to arrest two students of Merton College, Oxford, a pair known as William James and John Gambligi, both of whom seemed to have been very good at evading capture. 5 months afterwards, at the instigation of Bishop Braybrook, the sheriffs were ordered to arrest the Londoner John Claydon and to produce him before the council on suspicion of heresy alongside another Londoner called John Brechtwell. A week later, possibly acting on information given by Brechtwell and Clayton, the London authorities were told to arrest John Gamlingay, Thomas Lucas, and Richard Welpington, all fellows of Merton College, Oxford. The exact nature of the crimes they're charged with is unknown, but they must have been serious, as immediately following their arrest, the Oxford students were taken to Beaumaris Castle. Clayton and Brechtwell, however, were kept in Newgate Prison until July 1395, when they were transferred to Conway Castle, and there they were to be kept, quote, so that no man may have speech or treaty with them, unquote. The arrest of the Oxford Lollards in London may well indicate that links existed between the heretics in the capital and the remaining supporters of the belief system at Merton College, which was Wycliffe's former college. Nothing is known of John Brechtwell, but his fellow prisoner, John Claydon, was probably one of the leaders of the London Lollard community at this time. Claydon had been a prosperous skinner, and he had served as a common councillor for Billingsgate Ward in 1384, 1386, and 1388. And as stated, back in June 1386, he had acted as one of the sureties for the release from prison of the late Mayor John de Northampton. Claydon and Brechtwell were kept in Conway until the year 1397, when they were finally moved to Fleet Prison, and there they remained until the 23rd of December 1399. On that date, they were released on the orders of King Henry IV, on the grounds that they had been imprisoned on verbal instruction only for a crime for which they were seemingly not guilty. Despite Claydon's alleged innocence, however, he was forced to abjure heresy before Henry IV's Chancellor, and only after that was he allowed to go free. After his release, however, Claydon remained an active Lollard, falling foul of the authorities again and finally suffering execution in 1415. As one of the few members of the London political establishment to wholeheartedly embrace the Lollard movement, Claydon is our most likely candidate for being one of the main leaders of the sect within the city. But after this clampdown, over the next 5 years, little is known about the activity of the London Lollards. And that could be because there may have been a degree of sympathy towards them within London ecclesiastical circles. Where this theory comes from was due to an incident that took place in 1397. Master William Thorpe had been arrested again and was imprisoned in the Bishop of London's prison by the Archbishop Arundel. His incarceration, however, apparently had nothing to do with him preaching in London 10 years earlier, and there is no evidence that he was arrested in London itself. He must have by now made his peace with Bishop Braybrooke concerning his earlier activities, for when Arundel was no longer on the scene round about September 1397, Braybrooke had him released, and Thorpe himself reported in 1407 that Braybrooke, quote, found in me no cause for to hold me longer in his prison, and at the request of my friends he delivered me to them, asking no manner of submitting, unquote. We have this impression that there was an inclination to be lenient towards these suspected heretics, a possibility that could partly explain the small number of prosecutions for being lollards during Bishop Braybrooke's term as Bishop of London, which lasted from 1381 to about 1404. Could it be that the heresy was allowed to survive because of a quiet nod from the bishop? We don't know. But certainly, no matter what's happened, the community seems to be thriving and growing. Around the spring of the year 1400, the London Lollards were apparently active enough to cause the government concern again, and on the 12th of May, a writ was sent to the sheriffs informing them that much heresy was being preached within the city, and ordering them to publicly prohibit any chapel in London from preaching unless he'd been licensed to do so by Braybrooke. They were out there, the mumblers of London, growing, whispering, talking of their ecstatic faith. The London Lollards were most probably the instigators in a small-scale bit of agitation that happened in early January 1401, and that was sparked off by the visit of the Greek Emperor Manuel II and his entourage. See, they did not respond, like many did, by going, oh, look how strange these foreigners are, upon seeing their orthodox Christian practices. Rather, the Lollards of London saw religious services being carried out in a vernacular language, a language spoken by the priests and the laity, and the laity were joining in as much as the clergy were. As a result of this, petitions were sent to the king and also to Parliament, which met on the 21st of January that year, asking that Bibles and services in English should also be permitted. So head-turning were the demands from the London Lollards that the king employed Richard Hall, the Chancellor of Cambridge, to explain in a sermon delivered at St. Paul's Cross, that big preaching pulpit just outside of St. Paul's Cathedral, on the 23rd of January, that the Greek in which these services were being held was a different language from that used by the common Greeks. You can almost hear normal Londoners who probably had their head turned by the Lollard neighbours at the idea of having mass in comprehensible English and not incomprehensible Latin, hear this sermon and go, ah, so it's like Greek Latin, innit? But because of incidents like this and other incidents across the country, there was a hardening of national attitudes towards the Lollards, and the movement suffered a considerable setback in the form of a new statute, De Heretico Coberendo, which decreed execution by burning for all relapsed heretics. And the first person to suffer from this new law we covered back in chapter 144, a priest originally from Norfolk, William Surtee, who in May 1399 had abjured heresy before the Bishop of Norwich and had received a royal pardon in 1400, but then, to escape the notice of Norwich authorities, moved to London and obtained the ability to preach in a London church. He'd soon returned to his old heretical ways, preaching the same doctrines in London as he held in Norfolk, and as such he was again arrested and appeared before the Archbishop at St. Paul's on the 12th of February. As we described in that chapter, Surtee was burned alive in Smithfield, calling down curses on king and kingdom. A few days after that, on the 28th of February, John Purvey then appeared before the Archbishop at St. Paul's Cathedral. Now, he'd been previously arrested somewhere in the country, we don't know where and how. Now, Purvey was an important catch for the ecclesiastical authorities, for he'd been Wycliffe's secretary, and in 1401, he was probably the most high-profile and prominent member of the Lollard sect in the country. The problem the authorities had was he had never been tried before and therefore could not be accused of relapsing. The Lollards of London were no doubt shaken, both by the brutal nature of Surtees's execution. And then, on the 6th of March, Purvey, standing before a huge crowd outside St. Paul's Cross, recanting all his heresies and religious beliefs. After 1401, Purvey did retreat into obscurity and dubious orthodoxy, quote, showing himself neither hot nor cold, unquote, for nearly 15 years. He does turn up in the revolt that is to come. But to return to our narrative, with the execution of Surtees and the public recantation of Purvey, we get the impression this was a considerable blow to the Lollard movement, and especially to London's Lollards, many of whom would have witnessed both these events and were beginning to realise just how dangerous it had become to hold these beliefs. Indeed, there is evidence that a number of voluntary recantations occurred at about this time, especially amongst the London Lollards. According to sources, some of Surtees's companions and parishioners, moved by these terrible events, publicly revoked their heresies at St. Paul's Cross. And on the 17th of November, 1401, the Archbishop sent a commission to the prior of St. Bartholomew Smithfield, licensing him to hear abjurations and to absolve penitent heretics from excommunication. The preamble in the writing to this commission states that many persons who lately believed, wrote, and taught heretical opinions have, by the inspiration of divine grace, voluntarily submitted themselves for correction. Yes, divine grace caused by watching other members of your belief system burn alive screaming on the streets. Yeah, that kind of divine grace. Now, the identity of those Lollards from London who recanted in 1401, we don't know. But there is a court case in 1402 where we get to see the names of four Londoners suddenly brought before the Archbishop and a number of other bishops for a trial, even if very little else about them can be discovered. The first is a man called Richard Herbert, and he absolutely denied holding any beliefs of which he was accused. But at the same time, he was still forced to abjure all heresies and errors, and at the same time, he was forbidden from attending heretical meetings and conventicles before he was released. The second person brought in was a man called John Saynor, and he was altogether a more curious case. Saynor came from Dunton Bassett in Leicestershire, and on the 19th of April back in 1400, he'd abjured six very definitely Lollard heresies concerning transubstantiation and the veneration of images, back before the Archbishop at Canterbury Cathedral. But now he was brought back, seemingly going back on his word. But Saynor comes across as a slightly unstable character, and this time he turns up holding two completely different heresies that had nothing to do with the Lollards, namely that the Sabbath should be kept according to Jewish laws and rites, and that pork ought to never be eaten. This was not recanting on his old beliefs, this was coming up with whole new heresies. The bishops were a bit puzzled how to handle his abrupt change of doctrine, and he was ordered to be kept in the Bishop of London's prison until such time as the Archbishop had taken the advice of his colleagues. Let's move on, shall we, boys? The third person to appear was a woman called Emota Wiley. She denied believing in any of the statements of heresy laid against her, but she did admit, quote, that she had often heard such things exchanged between certain people, whose names and personalities she was completely unaware of, in the past, unquote. She too was compelled to abjure all heresies and forbidden from attending any illegal meetings. And finally, a heretic from south of the river, Nicholas Otterley of Southwark, appeared before the Archbishop at Lambeth Palace. He was accused of heresy and of associating with other heretics, but after examination he was allowed to abjure these beliefs, swear on the Bible to abandon both these beliefs and his associations with these people, and before being released also had to promise that within a fortnight he'd move away from the area. Between this and the actions a year before, the clampdown seems to have removed the momentum of the Lollards of London, but it did not wipe them out altogether. Yet, certainly, the traces of London's Lollards now become more harder to find between the years 1402 and the outbreak of the revolt in 1414. In 1406, however, a considerable stir was caused in London by a sermon given at Paul's Cross by Master William Taylor, then the principal of St. Edmund's Hall, Oxford. Amongst other things, he incited the people to believe that maybe it was a good idea to take away the church's rich possessions, and maybe the wealth of the church should be surrendered to the people. The church lost no time in making a response to this, and the next day a well-known preacher, Richard Elkerton, was sent to St. Paul's Cross to refute Taylor's arguments. Quote, that all the plunderers of ecclesiastical goods, without exception, are bound by the bond of anathema, unquote. Now, it's interesting because many of Elkerton's audience, however, were less than pleased with his sermon, and it does appear that he received a rather hostile reception. William Thorpe, the former Lollard, declared that, quote, I think certainly there was no man nor woman that hated verily sin and loved virtues, hearing the sermon of the Clerk of Oxford, and also Elkerton's sermon, but they say, or might justly say, that Elkerton reproved the clerk untruly and slandered him wrongfully and uncharitably, unquote. Elkerton didn't just attract the disapproval and derision of the Lollards in the crowd. He clearly annoyed somebody called Roger Waterton, who was an esquire of the king and a member of the Privy Council and a close friend of Henry IV. Immediately after his sermon, Waterton mockingly sent Elkerton a curry comb, which is a comb that was used for dusting horses to make a battered horse look glamorous, as if suggesting that the Elkerton's brilliant speech was really him being flattered by the uppers in the church to go out and do a crap job. The preacher was outraged and immediately took the object to the Archbishop of Canterbury, who in turn brought it to the king. Henry took one look at it, saw the insult, and burst out laughing. But the Archbishop was taking the matter seriously, and Waterton was forced to make a public apology in Parliament. The Archbishop was probably right to be alarmed at this point. For just as there were some who mocked Elkerton's sermon, there are apparently many who approved of Taylor's, which was written down in Latin and English, quote, and many men have it, and they set great price thereby, unquote. Indeed, so numerous seemingly were Taylor's supporters, and so widespread was the agitation for the disembowelment of the church, that on the 22nd of November 1406, Prince Henry and both Houses of Parliament petitioned the king for the punishment of those who, quote, proposing to move the hearts of good Christians against the so-called church and the prelates and the ministers thereof, both in public sermons as in conventions and secret places called schools, they have erroneously and maliciously publicly incited and moved the people of your kingdom to oppose and toll the said prelates and ministers of the church on their said temporal possessions. Unquote. The cause of all the trouble, William Taylor himself was apparently arraigned before the Archbishop of Canterbury at Lambeth Palace, where for 2 days he defiantly maintained his heretical opinions. Oddly enough, he seems to have either escaped or to have been allowed to leave, but he was subsequently cited to appear again to answer for these heresies contained in his sermon and for other ones. Failing to appear, he was excommunicated. But by August 1407, he completely gone to ground, and he was not finally arrested until more than 10 years later. And it leads us to, as we're coming towards the reign of Henry V, with some unavoidable conclusions. What do we have at our hands? We have a community that has existed for years in the streets of the city, in secret. It does appear that for 3 decades, the mumblers of London, the Lollards of the city, had been out there, just out of reach. For myself, I do believe that the Bishop of London, while not sympathetic to their cause, was sympathising to the people. And indeed, despite the ongoing concerns and condemnations of the Lollards, you get this impression, going back to the Peasants' Revolt and more, that ultimately the Lollards had more sympathisers in London than actual members, and for many their opinions were worth allowing. Obviously, London being London, there was a pragmatic air to this attitude. The authorities could not allow lollard preachers just turn up and preach in churches. But the court records and documents do suggest that they never went hard against the lollards who practiced in their own homes and who spread their heresies in private. Like a gorse fire, it was smouldering below the surface, sending up enough smoke to alarm the national authorities. But I cannot help but feel that the Londoners themselves were willing to allow their fellow residents just get on with it if they didn't do anything stupid. Don't be silly buggers, eh? Unfortunately, the lollards did indeed become silly buggers. And suddenly, round about 1413 and 1414, they were about to respond to the situation in the country and their ongoing persecution with violence. And I'll continue that in the next episode. Thanks for listening. Next episode, I'll see if I can get out this week, but probably come out next week. And I hope you enjoyed this one. This is Saul, hoping you're enjoying the gorgeous weather here in London this week. And yeah, I'll see you anon. Bye.